looking at colonial America was some growth, and then looking at a little bit of history of our own peculiar group of people known as landmarkers. So be patient with me, and we'll get through it by lunch tomorrow, okay? We'll be talking and looking at a church that you can't see very well, but it really is the United John Clark Memorial Missionary or Baptist Church. In other words, the First Baptist Church in Newport, Rhode Island, was organized in 1638, and or rather, 1638 in the fall. John Clark came from England. He was a very well-educated man. He had a degree in medicine. He had a degree in several other areas. He was, I think, 34 years old when he came here. And he came in March of 1638. And then in the fall of 1638, a group of people who already had come to Newport, they decided to organize into a church. And you'll notice that the literature generally speaks of the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island, being the First Baptist Church in America, and it shows an organizational date of 1639. The reason there is discrepancy there is that the First Baptist Church of Providence built a building in 1639, but the group in Newport didn't build a building until a year or two later, I think in 1640. So they said, no, you were really not a church because you didn't have a building. But the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island is a term that is trademarked. So no one else can use that term anymore in a legitimate way anyway. So there were three churches in Newport. There was a First Baptist Church and a Second Baptist Church and a Third Baptist Church, and I think even a Fourth Baptist Church that was a Seventh-day Baptist Church. And so after Newport lost a lot of its population, they decided to go together, three churches, and call themselves the United Baptist Church. And so they included the name of John Clark in the name of the church, but it's just generally known as the United Baptist Church of Newport. That's the title on it. I was up there several years, and when I went back again, was going to make a lot of really good photographs. Guess what? Didn't work either. This is the inside of the building, and it's they've really built a beautiful building. But you'll notice that all of these pews have a gate that you go in and sit down. And originally, the revenue that kept the church going was by renting the pew. Okay. Every family rented one pew or two pews, and that's how the building was kept up, how the pastor was paid. But they also had some free seats, generally in the balcony. And you'll see that a lot of churches did the same thing. Now here, you'll see another thing that's very unusual, and that is the communion set is up in the middle. And on one side is a lectern where the announcements and the song director is, and over here's another where the preacher preaches his sermon. Now this was changed back in the 1980s, because they consider themselves a Protestant church. So this is the format of any Protestant church. The communion is the center of their worship. Announcements cannot be made from the pulpit, and the pulpit can't be used for announcements. So they separated those with the idea that this is what you see when you go in, this is where you preach, this is where you make announcements, song leading. And the pastor that was there when I was there first, he did not like it at all, because he said the pulpit should be in the middle and should be the focus of attention rather than communion. But he said, I just don't have enough people to change it now. So I assume that it has stayed that way for a long period of time. There were kneeling rails on the pews, and also some areas where you could put a charcoal bucket or warm brick or something and set it on the floor to keep your feet warm in the wintertime. This is the tombstone of Dr. John Clark. This was a pastor when I was there. He's now deceased. And this is the picture of Dr. John Clark. As I said, he was in the formation of the church. He was also the one who went to England and stayed there almost 10 years trying to get a charter, because they were not protected by any English laws, any English troops or anything. They were just out there without any real protection or help. And Dr. Clark's finally got Charles II. We had Charles I, who was king under right after James I. Then we had James I, and then we had a Lord Protector, Cromwell. That didn't work, so they went back to the monarchy. That was Charles I. Charles I didn't work out well, so they went to Charles II, and then he's the one who granted a charter to Rhode Island and to where Providence and Newport both were there. So there's a charter for Rhode Island. But in his will, he left all the land that he had on this particular property to a perpetual fund so that young people in the church could go to college. That consisted of about 180 acres of ground and the corn and all these things, with a certain bit of it going to the church, and it was run by the men's Sunday school class, who were the trustees of it. Well, it really didn't return much money for a long time after farming went out, but after it began to be a place where people wanted vacation homes and things like that, it got to be very valuable, and they sold some of the property off, put it in the fund, and it still helped some young people go to college. And this was, his death was about the latter years of 1600. So he drew up the charter, which was the charter for the Rhode Island for until about 1784. So he was a very brilliant man and a very devout Christian man. This is the what's written on his tombstone, and there's a special cemetery where the church is, just down from United Baptist Church, a little area close to a creek, where they set aside for the pastors of this First Baptist Church of Newport to be buried. I think there are three pastors buried there, and their wives are buried there, and that's all that ever took advantage of it. This is a artist's concept of the beating of Obadiah Holmes. Obadiah Holmes, along with two other men and Dr. John Clark, went to a little village near Boston, Massachusetts, where one of their members had gone because he was elderly and blind. And yet he wanted to hear them preach, and he wanted to observe the supper with them. Now, this was a Baptist tradition that the pastor didn't go and offer the Lord's Supper, but as many of the members that could go would go, and they would vote to have the Lord's Supper at a certain place at a certain time, so that it would be closed communion instead of just carrying the communion cup as a pastor. There have been incidents when churches did that in frontier days. They would say, we're going to have the Lord's Supper on a certain date, certain time, at Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so's home, and all members should gather there. Well, ever how many members gathered there, they observed the supper. So So this is what they did. And at this time, it was not legal in Massachusetts, which was a state church, had a state church, the Congregationalists, which was the form of government that they practiced, but Anglican religion. In other words, when they came in 1620 and settled at Boston, they really wanted to be a democratic body, so they had to separate or be Puritans and purify themselves from the Anglican Church. But their doctrines were Anglican. The truth that you probably have heard preachers say, but not politicians, is that groups came to America for religious freedom, but not for everyone's religious freedom. That is, we came and set up our colony, and we made the religion that we practice the state religion. You have to pay taxes, and the taxes are used to pay for the church buildings and property and for the preacher's support. They passed laws, very severe laws, that if you lived in the colony and you did not practice religion according to them, then you were subject to beatings and you were subject even to drownings if you insisted on not attending church. In Massachusetts, the Northeast, it was the Congregational Church that persecuted people very severely. Then in Virginia, which was named for the Virgin Queen, you had to practice the Anglican religion. If you go to Williamsburg, which I hope you all could do, I haven't had the opportunity yet, but it's a replica or just the town of Williamsburg, but that's where Patrick Henry was defending Baptists who were accused of not having a license to preach, and Patrick Henry was their attorney when they went to court. And, of course, he's the one who said, give me liberty or give me death. So he was a freedom-loving person. And all of the colonies had a state religion in each colony with the exception of Rhode Island. Pennsylvania was Quakers. They settled it. Maryland, Lord Baltimore, Catholic. So there was no freedom of conscience or freedom of religion in America until the Articles of Confederation were set aside and the Constitution was finally adopted, and then the Ten Amendments finally added to it. And this was in 1791. So from 1620 to 1791, there was no religious liberty in America, except you were so far out on the frontier, nobody could catch you, or you were in Rhode Island, one or the other. But Obadiah Holmes and his company went to visit with this man on a Saturday. They spent the night. They were discussing the scriptures and observing the supper on the Sunday, and they were arrested. And they were taken to court near where a college is located today. We tried to find the exact spot. Some people said they knew where it was, but we never did find the exact spot where it was located. But he was the one who said, I will not pay a fine. John Clark and others said they would not pay a fine, but other people came and paid their fines. But Obadiah Holmes would not let them pay his fines. So he was severely beaten. And while they were whipping him, he said, it feels as though roses were stroking my back. He was beaten so severely that he couldn't sleep except on his stomach for a year. And in about a year and a half, he died from complications from this beating. And this is a genuine, true Baptist, not somebody that you say, well, we wish he were a Baptist. This Obadiah Holmes, John Clark, these were real Baptist people. This is where he's buried, at Midtown, between Newport and Providence. Yeah. This is Roger Williams. You'll read about Roger Williams in our American histories, but you will not read about Obadiah Holmes, nor will you read about John Clark. But Roger Williams was born in England in 16, and I forget what date, but in 1634 he came to America. Roger Williams was born of a rather wealthy family, and he was born near the Newgate Prison. Now, at the Newgate Prison, they would oftentimes bring the people who were convicted of breaking the Sabbath or not going to church or not having their infants baptized, and they would bring them outside, just outside the gate, and administer the punishment, which was generally a beating or something of that nature, or being branded with an H on their forehead or their side of their face, which meant heretic, just like you'd brand a cow or some animal. But he saw so much violence over the religious issues that he was very deeply concerned about it. In fact, he wrote a pamphlet against that, and that's why he had to come to America. He knew that they were going to arrest him and put him in prison, so he and his wife came to America. He went to Boston because he thought, I can work there and see where I could maybe pastor churches or start another church. But they were so radical in their punishment of everyone who broke any of their laws that he fought them. Finally, he was banished from the colony, spent a winter with the Indians, and finally went to the area that we would call Rhode Island. He bought property from the Indians and made friends with the Indians and actually evangelized them. And it was, as I said, Rhode Island plantation until they got a charter. But he was the first person that actually said, you don't have to go to church in order to be a good citizen. And by that he meant that the people who dissented from the Anglican Church, the Congregational Church, that they could be honest people, that they could be moral people, and they didn't have to swear allegiance to a particular church in order to hold an office. There's been a religious test in almost every charter of every state as they start into write their constitution. And I think the state of Arkansas has that they are a believer in Jesus Christ as part of the criteria for becoming an officer of the state of Arkansas. Now, they don't say anything about it anymore, but they've stuck pretty severe there. He wanted to be a Baptist because he saw how fervent they were. So in order to get baptism, one guy baptized another guy, Ezekiel Holloman. Then that guy baptized him. Then they baptized Roger Williams. So there was no church authority or anything of that nature. He really never became a Baptist and finally exercised his own beliefs by quitting going to church. This is the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island. The reason that steeple looks so out of place on a small building is because in England you could not be called a church and you could not have a steeple on your building. You could be called a chapel. Now, things have changed a little bit in England, but there are still restrictions on the churches in England. For instance, if I were a pastor in England, pastoring a Baptist church, and someone wanted to get married, I could not perform the ceremony unless an Episcopal priest or Anglican priest was in the congregation to sign the papers and note it. That's still in effect today. But that has been hit by hurricanes about three times. They've always insisted on building it back. It was sort of, we couldn't build one in England, we just show you what we can do, which is kind of a Baptist attitude. We'll just show you we can do this, and so they did. But on there, this is the inside of this building. After it had been there a few years, it became pretty much the heart of the city. And there was a family in the city by the name of Browns, and they were ship owners, and they made a lot of money with their ships. And one or two of them became members, but one of them, who was the most influential and the wealthiest, would not become a member. Although he did profess to be a Christian, he did not want to be put under the strict conditions of being a member of the church. But he gave tremendous amounts of money to the church, and he was a person under the church's protection and guidance, but not a member. And so later on, through the influence of the Pennypack Church near Philadelphia, they suggested at an associational meeting that they needed a Baptist college in America to train their ministers and teachers. And so it was thought it would be best at Providence. So they started the school, which was a Baptist-named college, that is the Baptist College at Providence. But because of the money he gave, they renamed it Brown University, which today, if you know anything about colleges or universities, when you're looking up to see which one it has the wildest parties, it's Brown University. That is, if you want a party college, the top college is Brown University, which just tells you something about nothing ever stays the same unless people absolutely stay on their toes and watch it and insist on. You can't do that. And we have just let our school systems generally, we have let our university systems, we've let our educational institutions, our government, just slowly and slowly encroach and encroach and encroach and encroach until America is like Brown University. We're hardly a nation that loves freedom anymore for ourselves. That I throw that in extra, okay? This is where it states that it was organized in 1639. This is the pulpit at Pennypack Baptist Church. And the pulpit is very high. And the reason it's very high, because you looked straight at the people who were in the balcony at the back. The balcony was generally reserved for slaves or for blacks. There were not any slaves in that particular area, but if they had escaped and came into that area, they could either sit on the like a balcony along the side on each side. In other words, there's three balconies, one on each side and one in the back, and these were the free seats in the church. So this is a very historic church. It was organized in 1687 and is the third oldest church in America, and one was at Cold Springs, organized in 1684, but it didn't last a long time. But Pennypack is about, I'm not sure, 30 miles out of Philadelphia, but it was the mother church of many other churches in the whole Northeast, and is the church from which, over, around which the Philadelphia Association was organized in 1707. So there were five churches that went into its organization. And the Philadelphia Convention is really not, it's stronger Calvinistically than we would like, so very few churches ever adopted it when they organized into a church. Our churches that we have generally traced our heritage through adopted the New Hampshire Confession, which was another association that was organized about 40 years later. But this is an extremely historic church. People would go into Philadelphia and hold meetings, and finally they built a church in Philadelphia, and then they came out of Philadelphia to meet and worship once every year, and they still do that. In other words, once a year, there are members that come from Philadelphia's First Baptist Church and worship here. But its membership was very strong in the Revolutionary War. The pastor of the church went from this church and served as a chaplain in Washington's army. They also stretched barriers across the river on which this Pennypeck Creek ran into. And they stretched a cable across the river and tied what we would call mines to it to keep ships from sailing up it during the Revolutionary War. So they were very active in politics. They were very active in the University of Pennsylvania. They were active in organizing churches all over the Northeast. So this is, if you want to use the term Mother Church, it has been a great church. Of course, now it's in the American Baptist Convention, which is the name that was taken from by the Northern Baptist Convention after the split into the Southern Baptist Convention and Northern Baptist Convention. They just changed their name about 60 years ago into the American Baptist Convention. They have women pastors. They have women deacons. There's about 170 non-pastoral offices you can hold, paid for by the association. They got more ministers than my dog had fleas when he was alive. He lost them soon after he died. But anyway, this is the type of thing you see in Baptist history constantly. Now, a group of people that came first to Pennypack Church, we don't really know what country they came from. They came evidently from several different areas, and some of them from England. But a group of people immigrated from Wales and came to America. At first, they attended church at the Pennypack Church, but they had a difference of opinion about laying on of hands. That is, laying on of hands was practiced in the same way that we ask people to come down front and shake hands with people who unite with our congregation, giving them the hand of fellowship. Well, this group from Wales did not believe you could be a true member and therefore partake of the Lord's Supper unless the congregation came around and laid their hands on you, or at least they had some representatives, such as the pastor and deacons, who would come and lay their hands on you. So they decided, we just won't say anything about this. Best way to get along is just not say anything about it. That lasted about 2 years. And they began to look around for land to buy that they could build a church and build their farms and have for themselves. They bought about 28,000 acres in what is now Delaware. And it was called the Welsh Tract, T-R-A-C-T. And there in the Welsh Tract, these people, the members of the Pennypack Church, granted them letters for the purpose of organizing Pennypack Church with a stipulation that this is not in anger, it's not in anything of that nature, that we love them and they love us, but since we couldn't walk together on this subject, we amicably and friendly and in the love of Christ separate ourselves. And so they organized this church. This church was standing during the Revolutionary War, during the War of 1812, and during the Civil War. And a cannonball went in this side of the building and came out where the big rectangle is on the other side. That's how old this property is there. There was, in front of the church, there were a lot of what we'd call sheds all together. And this is where they're wagons, their horses were kept during the bad weather. And it was long enough for many carriages and for horses they had ridden when they came here. Evidently, it was a very well-run church and a very wonderful church. But in 1845, there was a meeting at Black Rock in Delaware, what's now Delaware. And at that particular time, they decided, a group of people divided off and became Calvinists. And this church now is a Calvinist church. We asked them if we could see the church, and they said, you can walk around the outside all you want to. We said, could we possibly go in and look around? And they said, no, we don't admit people who are not true Baptists because y'all are not Calvinists. After some discussion, they said, well, do y'all have Sunday school? Yes, we do. Well, that's another strike against you. But when we showed up there at 10 o'clock one that morning, met one of the pastors in that area who came and met us, fella came with a key and opened it up and let us walk around on the stipulation that we would not have prayer. That would be a worship service. So we couldn't meet in that building and have prayer. We'd meet in the building, look around, and then go outside and have prayer. So they're still staying true to the Calvinist doctrine, at least. I think there's just a handful of them left, which is generally true of every Calvinist church. A building in Virginia. Virginia didn't have many Baptists in it until about 17 and 20 and 30. There's great revivals all along the East Coast, and the Baptists were very fervent in the other colonies. And so they decided that they would evangelize Virginia. And this was the rich people, generally. And they were the ones who were strict Anglicans. They were the ones that became the loyalists whenever the Revolutionary War was proposed. That is, we remain loyal to England. They fox hunted and rode their horses and had huge plantations. So they were very happy there. But men like James Ireland came in and started preaching wherever he could gather a crowd of people. But they would arrest him and they would warn him, you have to get a license before you preach. And his argument was, God gave me a license to preach when he called me, so I don't have to get one from you people. And it got really serious in the 1760s. But by 1775, there was actually a declaration of religious freedom that had really changed things a great deal. But many of the people had been whipped. They had been put in prison. They had been tarred and feathered. They had been threatened. James Ireland was put in a prison that I believe was here at this corner in, I believe, Culpeper. But anyway, they tried to assassinate him. The first thing they did, they put him in prison with a man who was mad, that is, insane, hoping that he was in the same jail with him, that this man, when he started ranting and raving about being saved and being born again, that this man would pounce on him and probably choke him to death or in some way kill him. Well, James Ireland was smarter than that. He made friends with him over a little bit and shared some of his warm clothing that his people would bring and hold him up on a long stick, long pole, and he could get things that way from his members of the church that or where he had been preaching. This man was finally converted, not in a long time, but in 3 or 4 weeks he was converted, and his change was so much that the jailer decided he's a bad influence on the people in the same prison, so we're going to put him somewhere else and away from them so he can't convert any other people. And they also tried to cause his death by throwing smoke bombs that had been loaded with dry pepper, so that they were hoping that this pepper would let off enough fumes and things that he would die from the smoke. He didn't die, and his health was kept up pretty good because his people kept holding up food and giving it to him through the windows of the prison. But whenever this settled down, the Revolutionary War was over, they had a constitution, the people bought the land where the jail was and tore it down and built a church on it, just sort of, again, a Baptist in-your-face move, which I sort of liked them for that kind of a circumstance. As I've said, there was really no true freedom in America. This is the type of thing you would see at every, what we would call county seat or square where the jail was. People were stripped and they were beaten. And when we saw this, we also were going to D.C. and we went to the Washington Cathedral, which is on the highest point just out of the District of Columbia. And they built this with the idea that this would be the church that America would use. It is an Anglican church, or what we'd call Episcopal church. They thought that after things settled down, then a union of state can be affected again, and this will be where all the presidents are inaugurated, be where the president's children are christened. It'll be where the weddings of their children take place. And it is a massive, massive building, like the cathedrals in Europe. But it's never become the national church, although it's called the National Cathedral. That's just what they named it. I understand Obama's been shopping around for a church, but I don't think he's attended this one yet. I don't think the pastor there is as fiery as Reverend Wright was. This is the stocks, and you would not be there for 3 hours. You would be there for days. They would bring you some water and a little food, but this was your punishment for some terrible crime against the state church. You didn't bring your children to the font for sprinkling. You missed church. Just whatever, you did something on the Sabbath that broke the Sabbath. This was a pretty severe type of punishment also. Sitting in the stocks, always in a public place where people could come by, throw rocks at you, call you bad names, and humiliate you. What happened? Well, we decided we'd been taxed by a group outside of the colonies. And so we were going to declare our independence or our freedom. The Revolutionary War was not popular. The leading politicians, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, these people knew what they wanted. They wanted a church. They wanted a government that had little power over the states. But they had to get through the war, and during the war, they just operated pretty well by what the confederacies of the states had decided to do under the Articles of Confederation. It did not have an executive department. It just had two departments. So there was no one to carry out the laws. So the states were supposed to do that, but the states, since there was no power over them, they just ignored whatever they were supposed to enforce that the judicial system had told them what to do, and they were supposed to do it, but the states were lax in it and didn't do it. So after the Revolutionary War, and here's where the Concord fight took place, the shot that was heard around the world. This is common knowledge, Freedom Bell in Philadelphia. And after the Constitution was finally adopted, a tremendous argument broke out, and it had always been there, and that was the two parties that existed after the Constitution, or during the fight to ratify the Constitution, was Federalist and Anti-Federalist. That was the only two parties there were. The Federalists said we must have a strong federal system. The Anti-Federalists said, no, that's what we had. We had a strong federal system working out of England, telling us what to do and overruling what we wanted to do as a state. We want all of the states to be independent except for trade, for raising an army. That is, we just want you to protect us against foreign powers. We want you to raise enough money to keep an army or that you can bring one into power. Also regulate trade so that trade and finances among all the colonies will be the same. They were tired of having different currencies in every colony. They were tired of having different measurements for grain and all of this in different colonies. They said, we want a standard colony for commerce, and we want to be protected. So there were pamphlets that were passed out, papers, arguments about whether we're going to be a federalist system or we're just going to be states that practice states' rights and with very little power exercised upon us by the federal government. So this was a tremendous argument, and it still is today. How much power should the federal government have over the people? How much power should they have to regulate your lives? That's still a very live argument among us. Well, the Constitution was ratified in 1789. Last states, 10 did, and then the last two also ratified it. But at this place, just for now is a little park by the side of the road, James Madison and John Leland, who was a very famous and solid Baptist preacher, they were running for representative in the new Congress. And looked like that they might lose, one of them might lose, and Patrick Henry would be elected, and he was very fiery about even having a constitution. He had been opposed to even that much extraneous government from the state government. So Leland and James Monroe decided that one of them would give so that they could have a majority against Patrick Henry, because Patrick Henry did not want any amendments made to the Constitution. He argued that the Constitution had enough laws and regulations, forget it, we're not going to do that. So the Baptists wanted a very strict clause about freedom. And so James Madison, when they met here in this place under this oak tree, they met there, and Leland said, okay, I'll withdraw from the race if you will promise to introduce some amendments that guarantee freedom of religion. And Madison agreed. He was elected. And then in 1791, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution was passed, wherein is guaranteed life, liberty, and no, that's not, that's the preamble. In Congress shall make no laws concerning the establishment of a religion, freedom of the press, etc., etc. It is the best worded short sentence type structure that guarantees us more than almost anything else in the world. The Second Amendment, these people wanted to carry their rifles. You see, the reason they couldn't really organize against the English troops was because they didn't have enough weapons to fight. And they said, we're never going to be caught this way anymore. We want every citizen, every man and his children, his sons, to have rifles in their home so that we can immediately be called into a militia and defend ourselves. Well, that's why the Second Amendment is there. There had always been the idea that if we're going to keep people from rebelling against authority, we have to take away their means of rebellion, which has normally been their weapons, such as especially rifles. This is a monument to that area. We like to have never found it. Ask people, did you ever hear of a monument on a certain highway that, no, never heard of that. Call the missionary for the, or the associational president of this area in Virginia, and he said, you know, I've never heard of anything like that. So finally we just called a guy that knew where it was, pastor of one of our churches, and he told us where it was, and we went there and found it. But that's a very historic place. It shows you that when we talk about Baptists not being political, we have to be political if we're going to keep what our forefathers earned for us. And he said, well, I just don't vote. You ought to be ashamed of yourself if you don't vote, because that's how we can keep ourselves separated from a too intrusive government. And that's where we're going to get hurt as Baptist people if we're really not careful. Because, as I've said, discipline of your children, not sending them to a public school, sending them to the church, or sending them to a church that doesn't believe in inclusivism, that believes in exclusionism, in the sense of we don't allow lost people to come in our church. No, we won't baptize anybody who asks us to. No, our church roles will not consist of people who live ungodly lives, publicly at least, and we know about it. So there's a lot to lose by keeping out of power strong governments that want to make us all work and walk in the same steps. And this, again, is a monument to that circumstance. This is the Cotton Grove Baptist Church just out of Jackson, Tennessee. The reason this church is important is because in the middle 1800s, 1840s, every little village had usually a Presbyterian church, a Baptist church, and a Methodist church, and that was about it. It may be 1,500, maybe 2,000 people, maybe 800 people. And after a while, because they were pretty well cut off from other areas, they started practicing inter-church worship. For instance, if we're going to ordain someone, we invite the Presbyterian preacher to come, the Methodist preacher to come, and they sit on the ordaining council, et cetera, et cetera. Then they got to where they actually were trading members back and forth, because a lot of the Methodists were immersed, a lot of the Presbyterians were immersed, so why can't we exchange members since we were baptized the same? About 1840, J.R. Graves, who had become the editor of the Tennessee Baptist, he'd gone to Nashville to teach school, and the First Baptist Church of Nashville, pastor was so busy, who'd been the editor of this little paper, that he turned it over to J.R. Graves. He read a book published in England claiming what we call perpetuity from Jesus Christ, and all through the ages that a New Testament church had really existed. Well, J.R. Graves read this and said, you know, I think he's right. And he made some investigation, checked it out, and finally said, we cannot recognize these as true churches. We can recognize them as societies who have a right to exist, to preach where they want to, but we can't invite them to the supper. We can't accept their baptism. And there was such a stir written in the Tennessee Baptist. One of them's entitled Landmarkism, or What Is Old Landmarkism? And that wording is kind of strange to us, but the sermons that were being preached by the Baptist people who believe that we should not invite these people to the supper or accept their baptism or invite them to our pulpits were called landmarkers, because they said constantly, do not remove the ancient landmarks. And the ancient landmarks were authority for baptism, and not inviting people of other faiths or denominations into our pulpits. And this stirred up a real firestorm. So they called a meeting for the churches to come and assemble here at this church. And it was halfway between Nashville and Memphis, or about that, on the railroad, so people could get here easily. And Cotton Grove was a very prosperous community, which, because it was a great piece of property for a land for growing cotton, a lot of it grown there and shipped out. So they met here and discussed this, and they actually had a vote of the people whether Baptist churches should invite other denominational preachers into the pulpit, whether there should be invitations when the Lord's Supper was given, whether anybody wanted to come, they could, or invite them to the ordination services, etc., etc. And they voted in a majority to recommend to the churches that they not invite preachers, etc., etc. And so the Landmark Movement was begun. And it became a very powerful force in the South and in the North. And by 1870, now this was after the Civil War, but the churches in the North, I read constantly of their landmark doctrines. I read in the South their landmark doctrines. And finally, and it wasn't until about 50 years ago that these began to erode in Baptist churches. Whether they were affiliated with Southern Baptist Convention, they were all landmarkers. When I came to school in Little Rock, there were two churches in Arkansas that came to the Arkansas State Convention who practiced open communion. Their messengers were not seated by the representatives of the churches of the Arkansas State Convention. Now, I don't think there's any church that does not have open communion in the convention system here in Arkansas. And there are some, but I'm not aware of it. I don't think there are here in Arkansas. So we have, our history goes back. It's been a persecuted group except for where we are today. We need to commit ourselves to the truths and to the teachings of the Word of God. We don't need to move away from what our forefathers believed. This is, again, this small church at Cotton Grove. And this is J.R. Graves, who was a tremendous author. He wrote he was the editor of the Tennessee Baptist during the Civil War. He had written a book called The Great Iron Wheel, which was very critical of the Southern Baptist, or rather of the Methodist Church. In fact, a Methodist bishop met him on the streets of Nashville and beat him severely with his cane because he had written this book, The Great Iron Wheel, which criticized the Methodist Church. Later on, during the Civil War, there were Northern troops who looked especially for all the plates and pictures and publications of John R. Graves, and they destroyed them in the city of Nashville when they set it on fire. They went specifically to his printing press and destroyed them. After the war, he was very much hounded and hunted because he had made a statement, and I heard this statement made by a history teacher when I was in college. Said, you know, there was a person named J.R. Graves that taught that Jesus never spoke against slavery. And he said, that's something to think about. This guy was a Presbyterian. What J.R. Graves said, and it was taken out of context and used against him for many years, was that Jesus did not attack slave owners per se, but he taught love and commitment and obedience to the government under which you find yourself living. And for that, he was ostracized and broke. But he went to Memphis, regathered his strength, and started publishing another paper and kept the idea alive in the South particularly. But he died in Memphis in poverty because he just never could really get things back together again. This is his tombstone. This is where his tomb is located, in Elmwood Cemetery, pretty well in the heart of Memphis. All right, turn the lights on. I hope that you've learned something from this. It's a very quick overview of who we are, what our heritage is, that we just right here in this little church can look back to Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Kentucky, South Carolina, where the people flowed into Arkansas and brought the true faith with them. And then for generations, we've preached it and taught it in schools that were used on Sunday for Baptist churches and little log cabins. And we were never a rich people, as other organizations were. There were Baptists who had money. We were very simple people. We never had stained glass windows in our churches until probably 1920s, that is, in landmark churches, because we wanted people to be able to walk up and look through the window and see what we were doing. Because they'd accused us of eating babies when we were observing the Lord's Supper. Oh, I saw them take a baby in there that night, and he didn't come out. I know what happened to him. So the Baptist said, we've got opaque windows here, but not clear. But every church I pastored for most of my life just had clear windows. And I said, what is this? And they said, no, you don't need stained glass windows. Man, that's crazy. Why? People can't look in and see what we're doing. We're open. We want people to see we're good people. We're not wicked people. We don't worship witches. We don't have blood covenants and all this crazy stuff. That Baptist people have been lied about so many times, you can't count it. And one of the biggest lies that's ever been told about Baptist people is, well, Baptist preacher, if you're not a Baptist, you can't go to heaven. We say, if you're born again, you'll go to heaven. That's the best statement. Catholics won't say that. You got to do what they say. But they're not criticized. Presbyterians, Methodists, they won't say that. I'll just say, if the Pope is born again, he'll go to heaven. Now, he's in the wrong worshiping category. But Baptists, whatever you want to say about Baptist people, they say that personal religion is personal. And if you believe in Jesus Christ and you've been born again, you are saved. And most people, well, I never heard that before. No, because you didn't go to a Baptist church. You went somewhere else and they told you this. So just remember, we are not inclusive about salvation from the viewpoint of you have to do this, you have to be baptized. We don't ever say that. I never heard a Baptist say you had to be baptized in order to be saved. Have you ever heard any Baptist preach that where you were? I haven't. So we've been maligned and accused and abused since our founder, Jesus Christ, was put to death. So let's just keep on being abused and maligned and misunderstood and stick with the Word of God.